Well, you can't get any more direct about China than this.
Are you willing to get involved militarily to defend Taiwan if it comes to that?
Yes.
You are?
That's a commitment we made. We support the One China policy. We support all that we've done in the past. But that does not mean, that China has the ability, the jurisdiction to go in and use force to take over Taiwan. So we stand firmly with Japan and with other nations that not to let that happen.
U.S. President Joe Biden ahead of the Quad talks in Tokyo today. Of course, the Quad was on the back burner for years until Donald Trump came along. And now, under Joe Biden's leadership, the Quad partnership between the U.S., India, Japan and Australia is back with gusto. It was long perceived as a partnership formed to counter China's growing assertiveness in the Pacific region. But no one was really ever willing to say that out in the open. Of course, Japan itself is also very worried about China's growing assertiveness in the region, and Japan also goes into these talks with ambitions of its own. To talk through those ambitions, I'm joined by Koichi Nakano, who is a political science professor at Sophia University in Tokyo. Professor Nakano, we have a new prime minister, the Australian prime minister, in these talks, but also the Japanese prime minister Fumio Kishida's first Quad meeting as well. How important is it for him to host these talks, and how is he going to use this platform to the best of Japan's interests?
Well, one thing, of course, is that, as you said, this is the first time that Mr. Kishida is actually meeting in person President Joe Biden as well. So it's an important meeting, of course, for any Japanese prime minister to get along well with the U.S. president. And so that's one thing, of course. And the whole Quad meeting was preceded by the first face-to-face bilateral meeting between Japan and the United States. But also, there is an upper house election coming up in July, and so Mr. Kishida wants to show to his voters that he's got a safe pair of hands and that he's very much a sort of, you know, world stage leader on the par with, all these other members of the Quad.
In fact, our heads of state are both going into this meeting with a lot of expectation to set an agenda. Your Prime Minister Kishida has only been in the job since October after Prime Minister Suga stepped down. I mean, who is Mr. Kishida? What do we know about him, and is he any different from his
Well, that's a good question, because I think a lot of Japanese people are also still trying to figure it out. Mr. Kishida is a leader of a faction within the ruling LDP, and he also served as the foreign minister of Mr. Abe for some time. And after that, he also served as the policy chief of the ruling party. But he was hardly a household name. And so people have been reading in the press that he's probably a bit more of a dove compared to Mr. Abe, who's a known hawk. But given the fact that he also served as the foreign minister of Mr. Abe for several years, in fact, it's quite unclear whether he's going to be any different. And if his record so far, including his utterances, are any guide, Mr. Kishida is very much following in the footsteps of Mr. Abe. And so, of course, the question is whether Mr. Kishida is really the man in charge, or is Mr. Abe is more of a puppet master here.
Of course, Japan is flanked by China to its south, nuclear-armed North Korea to the west, and Russia to the north. How much has the war in Ukraine, as it intensifies debates on national security, affected these sorts of, you know, concepts and dialogues in your country?
Well, I think, of course, the discussions about Japan's security policy has been around before the war in Ukraine began. But, of course, the conservative leaders of Japan, including Mr. Kishida, but also the conservative press here, have been sort of trying to make the most of the war in Ukraine and the real crisis in Europe as something that is immediately impacting on the Far East as well, which in fact doesn't really make that much geopolitical sense. Of course, the fact that Putin could act in such a unilateral way sends a shockwave, but it doesn't necessarily mean that Xi Jinping is now better positioned to do the same on Taiwan, for example. But you know, all kind of logic has been jammed to sort of heighten the sense of crisis that Japan is lagging behind in its security sort of, updating, and that, something like Quad is really vital, even though, of course, if you spend a moment thinking about this, this also has the danger of pushing China further into Russian embrace.
Of course, we need to understand that Japan still has a pacifist constitution after losing World War II. And just last month, members of the ruling Liberal Democrats put in a proposal to raise the country's defence budget from 1% to 2%. I think that would place Japan on par with NATO members. So how big a change of mindset and priority is this in Japan?
Right. So I think at this point, the government is still trying to sort of mobilize the popular sentiment to catch up with what they want to do. So I mentioned the upper house election that's coming up in July. And if the ruling LDP combined with the emerging right-wing party, Ishin, would gain a supermajority in the upper house too, then they consider that there will be a godsend opportunity of 3 years without national elections in which the final sort of, aspiration of the right wing in Japan to revise the pacifist constitution would finally become a reality. And so all of this discussion is predicated on this idea that, doing away with pacifism enshrined in the constitution is now a real prospect. But of course, when you think about a moment about this, increased spending, doubling the spending, of course, on defense in the next few years would also mean that much budget away from social security, welfare and education and medical needs in an aging society with a shrinking tax base. So it's far from certain that Mr. Kishida and Mr. Abe, who might be, the power behind the throne, would be able to get away with it all.
So what does the average Japanese citizen think about doubling the defence budget? Is it a source of security given those geopolitical strategic threats that your country faces? Or does it sort of suggest that there will be an intensification of those tensions that may lead to, in fact, using that defence budget in anger?
Right. So I don't think the average Japanese person has yet had the time to really think it through. The discussion is relatively new. And in fact, it's ironic that when Mr. Kishida was selected the leader of the ruling LDP last September, he was campaigning on the promise that he's going to double the income of the average Japanese in the next few years, not doubling the defense budget. And so now you've seen a very significant flip-flop, that is in the making. But I guess, it's really not sunk in with the people yet. And so, of course, in terms of security threat, I think more attention is given not so much on Japan getting attacked per se, but rather an emerging possible sort of confrontation between China and the United States over Taiwan would have Japan getting entrapped in the alliance relationship. And so if the money is going to spend for that, of course, people will have to think whether this is really, what the Japanese people want.
If you've just tuned in, I'm speaking with Koichi Nakano. He's a political science professor at Sophia University in Tokyo about the Quad talks currently on in Tokyo right here on RN Drive. Of course, the Quad was resurrected by Donald Trump in 2017, but it was actually a former Japanese Prime Minister, Shinzo Abe, who formalised it 10 years earlier. How much does Japan need the US to legitimise its ambitions in the region?
Well, I think there's been this sense that Japan will be abandoned in the alliance relationship after the Cold War ended. And particularly from the second half of the 1990s, the Japanese ruling elites have been fixated on this idea that Japan should do more in order to have the U.S. continued presence in East Asia. And so I think, it's really building on this idea that the relative power position between Japan and China is shifting, and Japan needs to be trusted sidekick of the United States in East Asia in order to be able to confront China. So I guess, you know, depending on the policy position of the U.S. government, Japan's tone has shifted. But by and large, it's really been to try to side with the United States as it tries to sort of vie for, you know, regional influence and domination vis-a-vis China. So the game is still on. But of course, you know, the situation in Ukraine complicated the matters further, of course, with India, another, of course, regional power in Asia, not, of course, being on the same page with, you know, vis-a-vis the sanctions against Russia. And so I think all of a sudden now, you know, there's an emphasis on courts. And its effectiveness. But until just yesterday, we were talking about how India was not on board. So it's a bit sort of, you know, hard to believe that, you know, that there's going to be all that much coming out of this particular meeting.
It is good to hear the Japanese perspective on the Quad. It's easy to fall into the trap of just thinking about it's what Australia would want and what China would want. But in terms of what Japan would want, would the Japanese seek a bit of support when it comes to the ongoing disputed territories with China and Russia? How likely will they be coming up as topics of conversation in this week's talks?
Well, I'm sure it's going to sort of be mentioned because, of course, you know, there's got to be a reason why it's worth doing this. But with regard to the so-called Northern Territories, the territorial dispute between Japan and Russia, the former Prime Minister Abe actually had a pretty cozy relationship with Putin before all this happened. And he essentially sort of, you know, gave up on Japan making claims on the Northern Territories, which the Russians effectively control since the end of the Second World War. So I don't think there is really any sort of urgent issue with Russia. And with China, I think with the, you know, the prospect of a possible confrontation between China and the U.S. over Taiwan is really, you know, taking so much more attention that the so-called Senkaku Diaoyu dispute is not really sort of being talked about in recent years. And so, of course, it's going to be mentioned. And of course, China is also making a claim for the these islands as well. But Taiwan is so much bigger of a fish that I think that's also why, you know, Biden sort of, you know, seemed to have made a decision to make another kind of speech in, you know, giving an answer that appears to be stepping ahead of the strategic ambiguity so far.
And just lastly, as you know, Australia has a new Prime Minister. It's his first international diplomatic outing. Has this been received in any particular way in Japan, either negatively or positively?
Oh, I think there's a lot of interest, of course, with the election of Mr. Albanese. And, you know, so there's been an attention to his, you know, sort of family background or his rise to prominence and his reputation in politics. And, of course, there's also been some media attention on the, you know, on how different Australia's China policy is going to be, even though I think the general tone is that there's not going to be that much difference at this point, given that people are sort of, you know, getting more worried about China's growing influence rather than looking at China as primarily an economic partner.
Yeah, a bit of a reset rather than a revolution, as you say. Thank you so much for your time tonight. Pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you.
Koichi Nakano is a political science professor at Sophia University in Tokyo here on RN Drive.
ABC RN helps you understand the world. Find more of our stories on the ABC Listen app.